MacCast, Saturday, July 27th, 2013. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Glad to be back here with you for another episode. We got a lot of great stuff to talk about. Apple had their quarterly results call earlier in the week, and we have those numbers to go over. More information, of course, on upcoming iPhone models, including that new low-cost iPhone. Apple doing some work picking up some companies in the mapping area, as well as looking for employees to help out with Siri stuff. So we got all of those things to talk about and a lot more. Also, I have a great bit of follow-up to a question we had on the last episode of the MacCast about doing word counts in PDFs. And we're going to have Bart Bichotz from the Mac Roundtable podcast, a co-member of the Mac Roundtable podcast with me, also appears regularly on Allison Sheridan's NoSillaCast podcast. He's a Unix nerd and actually has a solution for us that you can build yourself. We're going to talk about how to do that with a little bit of Automator and some other great hints and tips and tricks to get it into as well. Also, I wanted to mention that a couple of you might have found a little extra bonus episode of the MacCast in your feed this week. Turns out I accidentally dropped the latest membership episode into the wrong feed, so it showed up on the regular MacCast feed. I'm actually not too upset about that, though, because a lot of you really enjoyed the content. I got some great feedback. So if you received that episode, I hope you enjoyed it. It actually serves as a good example of the kind of content you can get if you become a MacCast member. No requirement to do that, but those folks do help support me in doing the podcast and being able to do this as a full-time kind of gig. So I appreciate everybody who supports the membership show, and very glad to have been able to share that extra content with you. Actually, we talked about iOS and some of the design stuff. I had read some great pieces and done some pretty deep thinking about what Apple was up to with some inspiration from some folks. So I just wanted to talk about that and kind of get that off my chest and go over the things that I had been thinking about. So that was fun. But like I said, we have a bunch of really great stories to get into in this episode, so I want to get to those. But before we do that, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of our show sponsors, and that is Smile. You know, I was thinking about this, and I own everything and have owned everything that Smile makes, and you probably should too. You should just grab one of everything they make, because they make awesome software. And I really do believe that. I really couldn't live without Text Expander. Anytime I find myself having to write or type the same thing more than once, it goes right into a new Text Expander snippet. As a matter of fact, I just did some information. I'm currently working on a beta test, and I needed to send my system specs every time I would send in a beta report or information to the beta team every time I needed to submit a ticket. So rather than type that stuff over and over again and constantly have to look it back up, went right into a Text Expander snippet, and now it saves me a ton of time. I also use a great set that I downloaded. You can download sets directly from Text Expander, and they have a great emoji one, and so I threw that in there. So now I don't have to use the input menu. I don't have to turn on the thing in the keyboard. Anytime I type a smiley, it converts it into the emoji version automatically. So Text Expander does that for me. And you can even have it work with situations where you need to expand text that has slight variance or different bits of data, because they have the fill-in forms and the whole optional sections. I use those quite frequently. It is just really powerful. And then on mobile, it's completely integrated into so many apps that if you get Text Expander Touch, one, you can sync over all your snippets, but then you can use them in pretty much all of your favorite text apps. All of the best text apps, in my opinion, have Text Expander Touch support built into them. So that is awesome. Also, PDF Pen said another thing, same kind of thing. I couldn't live without it. As a matter of fact, I just recommended it to one of my clients this week. He told me I need to make some small edits to PDFs so I don't have to go back to my designer and have her make changes. I don't want to have to pay for those. These are just simple little tweaks that I need. I just want to be able to update my PDF, and PDF Pen was perfect for that. For me, it saves me paper. It saves me having to print out and fill in fake forms and then rescan them back in. And by fake forms, I mean, those are the forms people send you. It's a PDF. Hey, can you fill this out? But you can't, there's no fill-in fields on it, right? Well, you can add those with Text Expander, or you can just add text to it and then throw your signature on there. You can avoid the fax machine. I've had people say, hey, can you print this out and fax it back, sign it and fax it back to me? Really? It's 2013. We shouldn't be faxing. Just use PDF Pen, put your signature in, fill in the information, and you can email it back to them. And again, PDF Pen on the iPhone and the iPad lets you do all of the same great stuff on the go. They've got iCloud and Dropbox support, so you can sync your documents over, have them right there to work on when you need them, and you can do it all on the go. So just awesome, awesome software. You really should check it out. Go to smilesoftware.com right now if you haven't already. And a big thank you to them for their support of the MacCast. So let's get into Apple's third quarter earnings. They did the announcement on, what, it was Tuesday, I think it was. And they actually had a pretty surprise, what I thought was a surprisingly good quarter. And I think analysts felt that way too afterward. They announced that they had revenue of $35.5 billion for the quarter, which showed a little bit of growth, about 1% growth year over year. It came in, though, at the top end of the guidance that they gave during the second quarter conference call. So I think that made investors pretty happy. I think they had given a range, and $35 billion was the top end of that range. So they came in there. Actually, net profits were $6.9 billion, which is amazing. It's still down from the $8.8 billion they did in the third quarter of last year. But let's face it, they haven't had any new product announcements save the new Haswell MacBook Airs in eight months. It's been 8 months. Can you believe that? So yeah, they're back weighting everything this year, and the fall is going to be, this next quarter is going to be their really big quarter. As a matter of fact, actually the last quarter, really the first quarter of 2014, which I think is Apple's, you know, the last quarter of this year, will turn out to be the big one. We might have some products. I think a lot of the analysis is thinking that Apple will get some products right out before the end of their Q4 results. So they should be a little bit stronger. Although I think at the end of the call, Apple was still giving pretty conservative guidance. But as far as how things broke down, iPhone sales were definitely the strongest. They announced that they sold 31.2 million units. That's up from 26 million iPhones sold last year. So that beat actually a lot of the estimates. And it's particularly amazing considering that we've got the iPhone 5S and the new low-cost iPhone being rumored right around the corner. So you would think buyers might be holding off a little bit, but a lot of analysts think the higher numbers were really propped up by sales of the lower cost iPhone 4 and 4S, especially in emerging markets. They have really helped prop up Apple's iPhone sales and resulted probably in some of the strong numbers for this quarter. iPad sales were actually down pretty significantly, 14.6 million units, down from 17 million in the same quarter a year ago. That's a pretty big decline, and according to TrendForce data, that means that the iPad captured 35.5% of the global tablet market in the second quarter. It's still a leading position in tablets, but it's down significantly from the 48.2% share that they had in the first quarter of the year, according to Strategy Analytics numbers. So they're moving down, but as the tablet sector is growing, there's becoming more players. Apple's market share numbers really aren't the whole story in this picture. As a matter of fact, Tim Cook was really quick to point out during the conference call that he was very excited about the actual usage data versus Android and the other tablets on the market. Chitika had numbers that said iPad's web usage share was about 84% of all tablets. So a lot of people still really confused, what are all these other tablets doing? We're seeing Apple's overall global share of the tablet space going down as more and more tablets flood into the market, especially lower cost tablets. But people really seem to be using Apple's devices to actually get online and connect. So other tablets, I'm assuming, are being used for games and media consumption and other uses. But seems like Apple's just still happy with the fact that people like using their iPads to surf the web. Overall, Piper Jaffray estimates that U.S. iOS mobile share for all devices, iPhones, smartphones, tablets, and what have you, is at about 63%. That's up 2.6% from June. Android usage was also, or Android share in the U.S. was also up 0.2%. So the 2.6% gain that Apple saw apparently came from losses not from Android, but from other mobile OSs. So I would assume BlackBerry and Nokia and Windows Phone. Mac sales also did very well for the quarter. 3.8 million Macs sold. That's down slightly from 4 million a year ago. In revenue, the Mac actually accounts for less than $5 billion of Apple's total revenue for the quarter. And that means now that the Mac is less than 15% of Apple's total business. So I found that stat to be particularly interesting. It used to be kind of a third and a third and a third between the iPhone, I think the iPad, and the Mac. But the Mac is becoming a smaller piece of what Apple does. I think it's just inevitable. And most of that, I think, is people going to tablets. And Tim Cook predicted it. They have said for a long time that they see consumers moving toward tablets as the computing platform of choice and becoming less and less dependent upon PCs. Not that PCs or Macs are going to go away, but that it'll just become a smaller part of their business. And we do seem to see that in the most recent numbers. They did also note, though, that the sales of the updated MacBook Air are going very, very well. Pretty much they're shipping them as fast as they can make them, and that's what Apple really likes to see. They're not leaving a lot of inventory in the channel. They didn't announce iPod numbers during the call, but the iPod numbers were put out, and they are down. I don't think it's surprising. 2.2 million units. Apple announced they sold 4.6 million iPods in the quarter. Another surprising number was that iTunes software and services accounted for $4.3 billion in revenue, so almost as much as Mac sales, and that was up 25% year over year. So the iTunes store and software and services is making Apple a lot of money, I think, with iTunes Radio on the horizon, and more people may be looking at things like iTunes Match. I would expect that we'll see those numbers continuing to rise. Also, just more people with more devices means Apple's selling more content in terms of movies and TV shows. I know that I personally am purchasing a lot more through the iTunes store, especially when it comes to movies. I'm finding I'm renting more movies and buying more movies. So I don't know if you're finding yourself in the same trend, but it's the convenience of the whole thing. And I really like that I can re-download and access my content pretty easily on Apple's platforms. And so that's made me feel more comfortable in buying digital content. And I think maybe other consumers are feeling the same way just based on the rise in revenue for iTunes. And then overall, what does that mean for Apple's cash on hand? Well, it is up again. It was $144.7 billion last quarter. It's now at $146.6 billion. So up, not huge, but still that's a lot of cash hanging around. And we know Apple's been making some acquisitions. Actually, we're going to talk about that here in a second. Well, as a matter of fact, let's just transition into that now. Apple is acquiring more mapping powers. They are working very hard to beef up their Apple Maps software, and it seems one of the ways that they will do that is by acquiring some other companies. It was announced this week that Apple acquired a crowdsourced location data company called Locationary, and my best guess is that they're going to use it to help Apple clean up and maintain all of the location data and business information data that they're getting from different sources, merging that together from their various partners to make a better system. This is something that actually Locationary's technologies are specifically designed for. It's what they excel at. They have technology for taking crowdsourced data on local businesses, and actually gathering that stuff is one element of the business. But more importantly, they say they have a federated data exchange platform called Saturn. And what that does is that takes all of that crowdsourced data from different sources, different people, and merges that together to create a single record, basically. So if you have varying types of information coming in, they can identify it as the same source, they can clean it up and put out more accurate data. And that's one of the challenges that Apple's had with their Maps software, was all this conflicting and confusing data that would come into play, and it would often cause incorrect or even duplicate addresses. You've probably seen it if you've done some searching on Apple's Maps. Sometimes you'll get the same address or same service multiple times for some reason, and they're saying that part of the reason you get that is this sort of mix matching of the data. And as a matter of fact, Locationary's CEO wrote a piece for TechCrunch last year on how Apple could better clean up and merge their data. He kind of gave, I think, 7 different points that Apple needed to work on. And of course, Locationary has the kinds of key technologies that could fix that stuff. And I guess Apple must have taken notice of it, or at least been aware of the company. And the key things that Locationary can provide to Apple are, one, that crowdsourced local data. So that means you have people in local areas actually inputting the data, either business owners or customers, consumers, and they're going to know the areas a little bit better. So you get that data coming in, but of course you want to vet that. You want to make sure it's accurate. So they can take that, they can aggregate that along with other data sets that Apple might have access to, Locationary sources, plus say like Yelp and the other data that Apple subscribes to, that can be all brought together and then standardized into the format that Apple needs for their mapping format. And that's actually trickier than you might think. That is a really complex process. So if that can be automated and made more accurate, that's going to be pretty important to beefing up the quality of Apple's Maps offering. And then they can match that up and recognize the duplicate data even when it's slightly different. And more importantly, it supports updating and removing old data in real time. So one of the examples they gave is if a location goes out of business or changes their hours or moves or something like that, you're going to want to know that pretty quickly. And this can, I guess, their technology, the Saturn technology, can do that in real time. So I think that's a key acquisition for Apple and should help on their mapping efforts. In addition, Apple also purchased a transit direction company called Hopstop. Hopstop provides directions in over 500 cities and offers the fastest way to travel from point to point on foot, bike, subway, by car. And this seems like another really good acquisition for Apple, because they lost that functionality, that at least built in, for the built-in transit directions when they moved away from Google Maps. So hopefully this means that they're going to be bringing transit directions back into the application. What they had done was they were relying on third-party external apps to get transit data. So you can get transit directions from Apple's Maps now, but the way it works is you have to jump out to a third-party application, and there's a handoff of that map system. So for me, like, I have Google Maps still on my iPad so that I can get transit directions, walking directions, and also Street View. I haven't heard anything about any acquisitions that would bring Street View like technology into Apple's Maps, but it's good to hear that they picked up this transit company. Now, they haven't announced what exactly they're going to do with it, but interestingly, right after the acquisition was announced, they did pull the Hopstop application from Windows Phone. So that was pretty much verification that Apple had acquired Hopstop, and they did later confirm it through a spokesperson. So the Hopstop and Locationary acquisitions are just two of the latest additions to Apple's mapping company purchases. They also purchased Wi-Fi Slam, 3C Technologies, Poly9, and PlaySpace. The latter ones of those were for the initial mapping effort. Wi-Fi Slam, it looks to be a company that does indoor kind of directions. So that's a feature that Google added recently, where you can kind of go inside different places and get maps internally, and it uses the Wi-Fi networks to do that. So I would assume Apple's trying to integrate also those types of technologies. And Tim Cook did say after the Apple Maps complaints that Apple would work hard to improve maps, and it seems like they're at least putting their money where their mouth is. I guess we'll have to wait and see now if they can come through on the integration and implementation of all of this stuff. They kind of stumbled a little bit before, but let's see what they're doing now, and they certainly aren't sitting still when it comes to maps. Got word this week that Apple is testing bigger and better, at least bigger iPads and bigger iPhones, of course. These are rumors. We've heard rumors of Apple testing bigger iPhones in the past. The rumors this week are from the usual places and sources, Asia and the parts suppliers. This time around, Apple is said to be testing iPads with screens as large as 13 inches, and that they're still testing and looking at iPhone displays that are larger than 4 inches. But, you know, here's the thing. Apple tests new sizes and form factors of devices all the time. So this doesn't necessarily mean that Apple's absolutely going to put these products out. They're just taking a look at what form factors might work, what kinds of products they might want to produce in the future. And when it comes to tablets and smartphones, it would make sense to look at larger devices, especially on the smartphone side, where there does seem to be a large contingent of consumers who want larger screen devices. And as for a 13-inch iPad, seems like a little bit too big of a tablet to me, but we do know there's some companies doing even larger tablets than that. And I also have to admit that I thought doing a 7-inch iPad was going to be something that was too small. Now, Apple's going to tell you it's an 8-inch iPad, but you know, I kind of discounted the mini. And now that it's out and I have one, I absolutely love my iPad mini. It's actually my favorite iPad, even without the Retina display. So I'm not going to say I'm going to rule out Apple ever doing a 13-inch iPad. 11 inches might make a little more sense. And with the popularity of the 11-inch and 13-inch MacBook Airs, the idea of something that combines that technology, say in the form factor of an iPad, sounds pretty intriguing. I'd be curious to know or think about if Apple would have something that would have the kind of ports and expansion in like a larger screen tablet. So something that maybe on your desk could almost become more of a desktop and then becomes this tablet that you sort of take with you. A lot of people have played around with that form factor. So I have a feeling Apple's trying to think through all of these things. And a great way to do that is to just prototype out and build some products. So at the very least, I can see how these kinds of thought processes and these form factors could be very, very interesting. And or at least I find it interesting. And if I find it interesting or we find it interesting, then it really shouldn't be surprising that Apple does as well and that they want to play around with it a little bit and see if something worthwhile might pop out one of these form factors. So I don't think this is a shocking story, but I'm at the same time, I'm not putting a whole lot of faith in something coming out imminently. But 2014, 2015, who knows? What do you think about the idea that the low-cost iPhone will actually be the new iPhone 4S or the update to the iPhone 4S? That sounds confusing, right? Because we're on the iPhone 5, why would we be updating the iPhone 4S? But here's the deal. I'm wondering if it'll take the position of what the iPhone 5 should become when the new 5S comes out. So normally, Apple's history has been to take the prior generation model, move that down, and that becomes the new lower cost entry level iPhone. So currently that's the 4S. That means when the 5S comes out, it should be the 5. But what if the low cost iPhone takes up that position? So I guess technically I should have said, what do you think about the new low cost iPhone becoming the new iPhone 5? And that's exactly kind of what the Korean site ET News claimed this week. They said that they had information saying that is exactly what Apple plans to do. I just figured, based on what I've been hearing about the form factor and the screen size and seeing some of the images, that was what Apple was planning to do all along. I guess the big news is that this really is a change from how Apple has been doing things. And I think ultimately it's a really smart move from a marketing standpoint, especially in the more mature smartphone market that exists now. It's a much better way to position the iPhone, because when Apple launches a new phone this time, it won't just be a new phone for the premium market, but they're also going to have a brand new phone for budget conscious consumers as well. And the interesting thing that is it, to me is that aside from the plastic case, what you have in terms of specs, at least what we're hearing about, is in essence an iPhone 5. Same size screen, same kind of processor, same camera, just in this plastic case, and with a price point, they're saying unsubsidized starting around $300 US. So I would suspect that at least initially that would allow carriers with subsidies to offer it at that $199, maybe $149 price point. And then I could see it quickly dropping to $99, say in about 6 months, something like that. And then eventually, probably toward the end of the year, into that free range. And so that means that you as a consumer are getting the new iPhone, even if you're going for the budget conscious model. You're not settling for last year's model, the iPhone 5, at a lower price, right? You're getting the new budget iPhone, or however they're going to market, iPhone Lite. I don't know what the marketing word's going to be for it, but the new low-cost iPhone. And so despite the fact that spec-wise, it is going to be the same thing, they're doing the same kind of transition behind the scenes, actually out in front for the consumer, they're getting this great feeling of buying the very latest and greatest brand new iPhone that's something completely new that hadn't been on the market before, looks different, and that good feeling goes a long way when you're selling these kinds of devices. I think consumers really respond to that, and I think Apple recognizes that, and so it's going to be interesting to see when this comes out, but I had kind of felt all along that this was sort of what Apple was planning on doing. When Apple updated the MacBook Air line back in June, a number of people were wondering where were the new MacBook Pros. We had thought, or there had been people who thought, that there might be a MacBook Pro update along with the update of the MacBook Airs to add in the new Haswell-based processors. And I think the current thinking is that Apple plans to update the MacBook Pros in the September timeframe. But the China Times is reporting this week that that deadline might be delayed just slightly until October. They said that the delay was due to production issues with the Retina-based displays, and that's where the story kind of lost some credibility to me, because Apple already makes these models with Retina displays, and as far as I know, they wouldn't be changing any of the display technology, so I wouldn't think that that would cause problems unless something's happened in the supply chain. I didn't notice or read in the story if Apple had changed the suppliers or was having trouble with any particular supplier, but overall, I think the design and the form factor for the next update would not be all that different. I think the big change would just be the processor and any updated graphics specs. And so it's really expected to be mostly a feature bump. I wouldn't expect to see a whole lot of real-world performance go up in terms of percentage. As a matter of fact, I think as far as the CPU goes, we're going to see just a slight increase. But the GPU actually might be a completely different story. And as a matter of fact, Mac Rumors was reporting that the site Semi-Accurate was claiming Apple is looking to Intel to actually supply a special version of the Haswell processor for the new Retina MacBook Pros. And to me, that seems like more the kind of thing that could delay a production schedule. If Intel's having to put together a special package for Apple, then that could add to the lead time for actually getting these things produced. What they're saying is that Apple plans to use one of the highest-end GT3E Iris Pro 5200 integrated graphics chips from Intel, coupled with a new i7 Haswell processor. And Intel claims that the Iris can offer 2 to 2.5 times the GPU performance of the current generation HD Graphics 4000 chip that Apple's using for the current MacBook Pros. And so it's not clear if Apple would also include a dedicated chip or not along with the Iris one that would be integrated into the Haswell chip. But I would assume they would continue to do like they do for the 15-inch model, use a dedicated as well as the internal, and then on the 13-inch model, just go with the integrated chip. But if battery life is a primary focus for these new models, like it was for Apple in the Air, they were really touting the battery life of the new MacBook Airs with the Haswell chips in them, then I could see if the Iris Pro offers enough performance boost, they could just go with the integrated graphics across the line. And that may be why they want a special package, something on the higher end range, so that they can eke the performance out. And as far as what that performance might be, well, Geekbench is saying that they've already seen some pre-release numbers showing up on their benchmarking site for what looks like to be a 15-inch MacBook Pro with a top-of-the-line Haswell Core i7 chip running at 2.4 gigahertz, along with that Iris Pro 5200 integrated graphics. And as far as the score goes, it came in at 12,497, which is about in line with the current generation MacBook Pros. Now, the thing to remember is this is likely pre-release numbers. It may not be completely tuned out. But more importantly, what Apple's probably going for is keeping the performance at the same levels while bringing in much improved battery life. So, you know, an hour, 2 hours more on the battery life of your MacBook Pro could be a nice significant bump, especially if they can keep performance in the same range or get it slightly better, maybe a 5-10% jump in CPU with just raw computing performance. That could be a pretty big deal. And there's speculation that in this round, Apple may choose to phase out the older non-Retina MacBook Pro models. I also think that would probably be likely. It's probably time for the non-Retina models to get phased out and replaced with pure Retina models. I don't know what that means for Apple trying to hit the lower end of the MacBook Pro market, if they'll take the existing models and sort of just ramp those down a little bit. We'll have to wait and see on that one. But KGI Securities analyst Ming-Chi Kuo suggested that the MacBook Pro update would be launching in mid-September. As we started this piece, there's also some speculation it could be slightly delayed to October, maybe early to October, so maybe just a couple weeks. But that September-October timeframe, it's looking like for update to the MacBook Pro line. We talked earlier about Apple acquiring some companies to help them beef up Apple Maps. Another technology in iOS that Apple has been looking to improve and continue to evolve is Siri. We know that in iOS 7, she's getting a new voice, including an all-new mail version, as well as just enhanced technology. And as part of those efforts, this week we had a site called Xconomy that is saying Apple has been assembling a small team of notable names in speech technology and is actually looking to expand that team in Boston. Apparently, they're hiring members and former employees of a company called Voice Signal Technologies. That's a speech software company that was purchased for $293 million by Nuance in 2007. Apple currently licenses and uses Nuance technology to enable Siri and the voice dictation features in both of its OSs, both iOS and macOS 10. Specifically, what this new team they're assembling in Boston is working on is a secret, but it's probably not too much of a stretch to assume that they're working on improvements to Siri and making that technology better. Some of the reports are speculating that Apple might be looking to build its own voice recognition and dictation technology in-house and eventually move away from Nuance. I don't really see a reason why Apple would want to do that. Nuance and Apple have seemingly had a great relationship and a partnership so far, and Nuance is really the leader in this field, in this technology, and they have great stuff. This isn't the kind of thing where what Apple had with Google, where Google was stealing their thunder. Now, Nuance does license technology to Apple's competitors, so maybe there's some concerns there, but I would think they would want to stick with that. I'm really hoping the new team is really there to make enhancements on the speech comprehension and analysis side of the equation, and also to add more predictive intelligence and technologies into Siri. I think Siri has great voice recognition. I think what Apple really needs to focus on now is the cognition, the understanding that Siri has, being able to take all of the data and information that's collected as you're interacting with Siri, things like where you're at, the GPS location data, the time, the kinds of information that is in your contacts, and take all of that information and better try to infer and understand what you're asking for, the information you're asking for, pull all that data together, process it. So I'm hoping it's not just the translation part of it, you know, doing the dictation, figuring out the words that you're saying, but I'm thinking that that data could come back into Apple's data centers from Nuance, and then they could build technologies on top of it to parse and just make Siri work better and seem more intelligent. And I this seems like the perfect kind of team and the perfect kind of technology for Apple to be focusing its efforts on, and hopefully these new hires in Boston, that's exactly what they're using them for. And then finally in the news for this week, a story we get to all take credit in because we had a hand in making it happen. iTunes and their podcasts have now reached 1 billion subscriptions. Apple announced last week that subscriptions to podcasts via iTunes have surpassed 1 billion. It's a huge milestone, and Apple even put up a special section in the podcast area of iTunes to commemorate the event, and it featured what they called some of the most popular podcasts of all time in a classics section. And along with that, they also highlighted some of the currently hot and new and noteworthy titles. And as my good friend Ken Ray, using his usual tongue-in-cheek style, pointed out, many of the classic shows unfortunately didn't seem so classic. Apple chose to highlight shows like NPR's This American Life, which is an awesome podcast, one that I subscribe to. But they also focused on Real Time with Bill Maher, which is from HBO podcast, Kevin Smith's Smodcast, and the oh-so-classic 60 Minutes podcast from CBS Radio. So some pretty mainstream and not so classic podcasts in that classic list, as far as I'm concerned. Not that they're not great podcasts, because they are, but it would have been nice if Apple could have focused on maybe some of the more true classics. Leo Laporte's Twit did make it in there, so that was good. But it would have been nice to see shows like The Daily Source Code, Adam Curry's show, one of the shows that started it all, still in there. He's not still producing it, so maybe not so relevant to put on the list, but certainly classic. But there's other shows that are still being produced that are definitely classic shows, shows like Coverville, Evil Genius Chronicles, Don and Drew, or even Geek News Central. Todd Cochran was doing that way back when I started out. So those would have been nice to see in there. But needless to say, huge milestone. And thank you all for being part of this whole podcast thing, because it's been a thrilling ride. And it's really cool that we now have 1 billion subscriptions just through iTunes. That doesn't even cover all of the other ways that podcasts get out there. So this thing continues to grow, and hopefully will continue to expand long into the future. And I will get to continue to bring you MacCasts for a very long time to come. And you've been a huge part of making this happen. So thank you. I'm going to kick the tips and tricks and feedback section of the show off with a trick this week, making a private me card in Contacts. This is actually something that I did in Contacts on my Mac years ago, and it's been a really handy thing for me ever since. I was reminded about this from a tip actually posted on the Mac Observer website. Melissa Holt did a great piece. I'll link to it in the show notes at maccast.com. And it reminded me that maybe not everybody's aware of how to set up a contact card that you can share, but only share certain bits of data and information. Maybe you don't want to share every little bit of data, like your birth date or maybe your relationships to other people in your address card. Maybe you don't want that stuff going out when you actually want to actually share your card with someone. And so probably the first thing I should do is go over and cover just exactly how you share a contact from your contacts application with someone else. A number of you may not even know that this feature exists. So the way I do it is I usually just open up Contacts and find the card that I want to share. It could be my card, my me card, or it could be some other bit of contact information I need to share with somebody. And then I just take that and I drag it into my email, into a Dropbox folder, wherever I need to put it. And what that does is it creates a .vcf file, a vcard file. And the person receiving it, as long as they have an application that supports vcards, that could be Apple Contacts. It could be on their contacts on their iOS device. It could be Google Contacts. They can simply open that up and it will import and add that information right into their contacts application. Could not be easier and a great way to share contacts. Also, in the contacts application, you can select the card and you can use the little share button down at the bottom of the window, the little square box with the arrow jumping out of it. Click on that and it'll give you a number of sharing options to send it via email or via iMessage or what have you. So you can also share out contacts that way. And so when you do share a card like this, the vCard file is actually going to contain all of the information that you see on the contact record in your application. So anything that you see on screen there is going to be included in that vCard, but your personal card, your Me card, can be different. And you can tell contacts which information you want included, and more importantly, which info you don't want included. So if you open up contacts, you should have a card for yourself. It'll be labeled with a little icon, looks like a little person in the list. And it, when you select it, you'll see when you're looking at the card in the photo, it'll say Me under that. That's how you know when you found the right card. If you don't see that, you may need to tell contacts which card is your card. So to do that, just find the card in the contacts list, the one that has your information on it. And if you don't have a card in there, you can create one. And then once you've done that, you just select that card from the list. And then in the card menu inside contacts, there's an option that says, make this my card. You do that, and then you'll get the little person icon next to it in the list, and your picture profile will have the word Me over it. And so then to tell it which information you want to share, or more importantly, not share, to create that private Me card, you just need to open up the preferences in contacts. So go to the contacts menu, select preferences, and then click on the vCard tab. And then in there, you'll notice a little checkbox that says enable private Me card. Check that on, and then you can quit out of the preferences, go back to your card in the contacts list, to your Me card, select it, and then set up the private and shared information options. If you can't, if you're having trouble finding your Me card when you get back into the contacts list, here's another little cool trick. You can go to the card menu and there's a go to my card option. So just select that. It'll jump you right to your card. And then when you're in your card, go ahead and click the edit button. And now that you've enabled that private Me card feature, you should see a share column over on the right with a bunch of checkboxes next to it. So you just check the data that you want included and then uncheck any data that you don't want included when you share your card. Once you've done that, you can click done, and now your private Me card is all set up, or your Me card with its private and public data is all set up. So now when you drag that out, when you share it, when you use the sharing options, it's only going to include the information that you selected. And that's a really cool little trick, and thanks to Melissa over at the Mac Observer for reminding me about that one. If you remember on the last show, we tried to help a listener who wanted to get word counts from a PDF file. So I had an existing PDF file and wanted to be able to quickly get word counts. And so I covered a number of solutions, a number of options, including an OS X service that you could get from Devon Technologies. I also talked about a command line that you can run in the terminal call or command line that you can run in the terminal called WC or word count. So you type WC dash W and then put in the path. I said put in the path to a text file and then it would give you the word count for that text file. Well, fellow podcaster and MacCast listener Bart Bouchatz actually emailed me, and he's a much more advanced Unix guru than I am, and he had some additional great tips that he wanted to let me know about, and he even created his own Mac OS X service using the WC command along with another useful command to actually get the information without having to point at a text file, without having to do a lot of extra work. And so I thought, you know what, this is a great opportunity. Let's get Bart on the line and let him discuss how to do these sorts of things, talk through what he did and what we sort of discovered. And what was cool is that his solution used Automator. So it gave us another opportunity, or gave me another opportunity, to talk to you about how cool Automator is and how you can do exactly the same thing that Bart did on your Mac for yourself. So you don't have to rely on somebody else's software because you have the tools built right into your Mac to make it happen. And so here is my conversation with Bart about this solution that he came up with. And it can be a not just this solution, as you'll hear. Once you have this knowledge, you can apply these sort of techniques to all kinds of stuff on your Mac. So this is really cool. Check it out. Hey, Bart, how you doing?
Yeah, not too bad at all.
Yeah, you've been working on some stuff since my last show. Little inspiration, I guess, taken from the question we had about how to do word counts in various applications, specifically Pages, I think is what the one we were talking about was.
I think it was PDFs, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah, that's right. My answer was Pages. I get things jumbled up in my head sometimes. Yeah, one way to do it was to use Pages. But yeah, it was a PDF, you're right, a PDF document. And how can I get a word count from that? So I covered a couple different things, but I know you, like myself, are not afraid to jump into the command line to open up a terminal. And I mentioned a couple of terminal things, but that can be a little bit daunting for some people. So you thought about it a little bit and kind of came up with a really cool solution using some of Apple's built-in technology. Some of the stuff that I think a lot of us tend to avoid, but is there and is super powerful. And I'm talking about AppleScript and Automator.
Yeah, one of the things that I love probably most about OS X is how easy it is to tie the GUI and the command line together.
Right.
So, it's a full Unix under there, so there's loads of really cool stuff just waiting for you to use. And in most operating systems, if you want to use the cool Unix-y terminal-y stuff, you got to get yourself dirty and be in the terminal. Whereas in OS X, using Automator, you can actually just tie it right into the GUI and not just, like, write your own app. You can actually insert it into every single app in your OS by using services.
Yeah.
And so you could write your own services from scratch, but the Automator app that comes free with every copy of OS X actually makes that very easy. And it's drag and drop up to the point where you got to type in the terminal commands because you're still going to type those in.
Right.
But when you're, you can't quite avoid that.
Right.
But the nice thing is when you're creating a service, you actually tell it where it should put the service. So at the top of it, there's the two drop downs, and you can say this service will accept either files or folders, or in this case, selected text in, and then you can choose what app or apps it should work in. So if you say service selects or accepts selected text in all applications, you just created an entire OS-wide service that can do whatever you want to do to your text, which of course in this case was do a word count. And you had mentioned the WC terminal command, which it does a word count. And then the other handy terminal command is PB paste, which pastes the content of the pasteboard, which is ye olde OS X, or not OS X, Mac OS Classic language for the clipboard.
Right.
And so if you take PB paste as your input to WC, then you've got a really easy way to get your word count. So my Automator action was just take the text. There's a nice handy action that comes as standard with Automator called copy to clipboard. So first action, copy to clipboard. So the selected text is now in the clipboard. The next action you want then is run shell script, which is basically where you stick your terminal commands. And the only actually icky bit, and this is something I wish Apple would fix, is that Automator is not very good at giving output.
Right.
There really should be an Automator action, say, create pop-up. But there isn't. So it's really good if you want to do things, but it's not good if you want to get results back. So I found a couple of ways of getting results back. One of them is to install growl. And there's a growl action that you can use easily, which is a nice way to get feedback. But another way I found is you can actually use AppleScript. And it's kind of weird, but you can use the terminal to run AppleScript. So if the terminal command to run an AppleScript command is OSAScript, so operating system AppleScript. And so the only slight complication in my solution is that you got to use this OSA script to create the little pop-up. And you just say, tell app system events to display alert, whatever you'd like to display in your pop-up, and up it pops. So I've written that all up as a blog post because I don't think talking about terminal commands is necessarily useful.
Well, I think it is. It's good for people to know that, and actually to see it as an example is great. So I love the fact that you put this up as a blog post, and we'll be sure to link to that in the show notes, and we'll mention it here in a second how you can go find that thing. So I looked at the thing earlier. Did you actually use a run shell script and then run the OSAX? Is it OSAX command?
OSA script. Yeah. A-script. So if you look in the blog post now, something I always do when I'm writing these is always give the full paths to things. So user bin pbscript, user bin wc, because otherwise it'll work fine on the command line, and then as soon as you try to use it in a service, it won't have the correct path set, and then it'll just fail silently and invisibly. So always use full paths, I guess, is the other tip. But yeah, if you look at the actual code, it's just two lines that go into that run shell script. The first line is your, you know, pb paste wc, and the second line is just the tell app system event to display alerts, blah, blah, blah.
Right. Because there, I mean, there actually is, I don't know if it would also work, but there is a run Apple script.
There is, but you got to get the
action
output.
And automator. You have to get
yeah,
what?
Yeah, but you got to get the output of your command line into your show, your dialog thing. So it's actually easier to do it through OSA script.
Ah, okay. See?
Because you see that I'm learning setting something. It into a variable. So word count equals run this terminal command, and then blah, 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 you know, print it out, and then dollar word count.
Right, right. I mean, the other thing I've often played around with, but it always just gets me somewhat confused, is I know in Automator there's also a way to set variables and get variables and things like that from different input. But is it the same kind of classic problem where you just can't get the output that you need going into the input?
Yeah, I've tried to use variables within services or within Automator, and it does work for some things, but sometimes the action you want doesn't support variables.
Right.
The one that really annoys me like that is that the growl action doesn't support variables. So you can create all of these lovely variables, and then you want to print the result out, and you try to send it to growl, and growl won't accept the variable. Then you're back to square one. And so I actually usually use growl from the command line within my Automator services.
Right, right.
Because when you install the full growl, there's actually command line tools. So you can actually just type on the terminal to growl notify, blah, 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 blah. And it'll spit up a nice growl message in your UI.
Well, cool. Cool. Yeah. And so I guess I wanted to end with, because I think a lot of people, you know, they maybe know about Automator. Maybe they actually opened it up and launched the application or something like that. And the thing I like to often do when I bring up Automator is just try and give people some advice and some tips and tricks. And I think one of the first ones is just to try it out. And yeah. I particularly like, I mean, your blog post, if people go look at it, I think it's two actions. You know, there's a little bit of AppleScript in there, but you can grab that from your post or just copy it and put it in there. But actually, you know, build this thing out yourself and just give it a try. See sort of how it works, right?
Yeah, and I generally think whenever I find myself repeating myself, doing the same fairly monotonous task over and over again, my mind immediately jumps to, right, I got to automate this and create it as a service. So when I right-click on stuff in the Finder, I have lots and lots of services to find. I mean, even simple stuff like I can right-click on any image in the Finder and call a service called Blogify Image, which resizes the image and puts a drop shadow around it.
Nice.
So just any time I find myself doing something repetitive, I just throw it into a little service. So I have one like you right-click on any file in the Finder and it'll give you the MD5 hash and stick it in the clipboard. In fact, the clipboard is a great way to get output from stuff as well if you use an Automator.
Yeah.
So you just
yeah.
throw in at the very bottom of your workflow, just throw in copy to clipboard.
Yeah, and it can solve a lot of problems that I think you, when you run across stuff, you're like, I don't really know how to do this. It's amazing how you can kind of connect things together, and it does take some time sometimes to figure out. Somebody sent me an email one time because Apple used to have in QuickTime this really cool sort of trailers feature, and they used to have a page you could go to, and it made it really easy to download trailers and all that. They changed all that stuff at one point, but sort of the URLs still existed, and if you knew kind of the secret way to figure out how to do it, you could get to the files and you could download them. But it was really hard, and it took a lot of steps, and I thought, you know, I bet you could use Automator, which can go out and get a URL, you know, you can pass it a URL, you can give it information, and then it can go out and grab stuff and pull it down and take it over to QuickTime. So I wrote a quick Automator for that, and it worked beautifully. You know, yeah. You could type in the name of the film that you were looking for, and it would actually pull it down. Now, that was got a little more complex, but it certainly could be done. And so the thing is, and you can turn them not just into services. If you want, they have an app option, too. When you open it up, yeah. One of the first things it says is what kind of project do you want to make? Do you want to make a service that's accessible everywhere? Do you want to make an app? Another really handy one that I use quite frequently is you can set up something that can be scheduled inside iCal. So if you need, you know, every night at a certain time, you want something to happen on your Mac, you could build an automator for that.
Yeah, actually, another nice one is this thing called folder actions, where basically whenever you drop a file into a folder with a folder action, do this automation on it.
Yeah.
So you could make a folder that every time you drop an image into it, that image gets resized to whatever size you want and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Or another thing, actually, that when you install apps, they often come with extra automator actions. So if you install Transmit, for example, which is a lovely FTP client, you get a whole bunch of free automator actions with it that allow you to do FTP and secure FTP from within automator. So if you want to do something, say, every night zip up this folder and FTP it to my server as a backup, you can do that.
Yeah. Yeah. And so I just encourage people to not, you know, be afraid of it. There's great tutorials out online. Find a really simple one. And just kind of see how it works. And it's really got a nice GUI. So you just drag things in. They have a good search feature. And actually, the documentation is pretty good. I'll say that the big tricks that I've learned as sort of working with it is when you select an action, make sure you have the little info panel open down in the lower left. So you get this list. They call it the library. And it's divided into things like the Finder or Mail or the Calendar. So you can kind of narrow down and you know, if you're going to do something, you want to do something with Mail, you can click on Mail and you can sort of browse through all the actions that they give you. But the one really important thing I found is make sure that little info panel is open. And if it's not, there's a little button down on the lower left to expand it. And when you select an action, it will show you what it takes as input, what it might provide as output. And that kind of lets you know. Because the way Automator works is you drag the actions in, you connect one thing to the other. You sort of do it linearly, almost like a, you know, a recipe. Do step one, then step two, then step three. But you have to kind of be aware of what's coming in. You know, if you have text coming in and the next thing needs to have, text coming out, you want to make sure that the input and the output are matched up correctly. That's the only thing that ever got me into trouble is like, why isn't this working? Oh, well, because this thing's expecting a URL and I'm giving it a block of text.
The other nice thing is if you're running it in the automator thingy, you can expand the little sort of expansion triangle on the bottom of every block or every action, as they're called, and it'll show you the results as you're propagating through the workflow. So you can actually just watch it trickle down and see what's arriving at each step.
Yeah, that's really handy.
And like you said, the most common thing is you're using an action that spits out a file and you're trying to funnel it into something that's expecting an image or that's expecting text or that's expecting a folder or something that's not a file. And at that stage, it will barf because it has no idea how to, say, zip up text when it's a zip action that's expecting a file.
Right, yeah. So pay attention to those. And very often, you'll be able to find an action that'll get you from one format to the other, too. So that's probably, you know, in most cases, that's what I'd usually do. It's like, okay, what am I missing? How can I get this text into a file? Oh, well, there's a thing that takes text and puts it into a text document. Perfect.
Yeah. And you can use you can actually insert another automator action into an automator action as a single step. So if you've written an automator action that does something quite complex, you can then just drag that in as a single step in future.
Oh, that's awesome. I didn't even know that.
Yeah, because one of the actions is run automator action. run automated workflow. So you can start to abstract it out. So if you do something very often, you can simply save that, and then instead of redoing it every time, just drop in the workflow as a unit.
Yeah, well, very cool. And last thing I think I'll close with is I think in that segment I did mention a service, the Word services. That's actually a whole group of services from the folks over, and I'm going to blow it now because I can't remember the name. It'll come to me, I'm sure, later. But the Word services thing has a word count that seems very similar to the action that you wrote up. So I have this feeling if we dug in, they probably did something very similar to what you did. And that's what I love about this is like you can do this yourself. You don't have to necessarily go out and find somebody else's thing. You can make your own thing.
Yeah, and because OS X is a Unix, there is so much waiting for you down on that command line.
Yeah, very, very cool. Well, thank you for doing that. Like I said, I will have a link in the show notes to Bart's service, but I would encourage you, read the blog post and just write it yourself. See what you can throw together. And Bart, I know you're kind of between actual podcasts at the moment, but you do guest on several shows. You want to talk about those and let people know where they can find you and give them also the URL to your site?
Sure. So my site is just bartb.ie because no one can spell my surname. and at the moment, really, I'm just doing Alison's show at the moment, which is the Nocilla cast over at podfeet.com. And I'm actually in the middle of a series there called Taming the Terminal, where we're actually starting from complete scratch and slowly every fortnight digging in a little deeper to hopefully get people comfortable and acclimatized in the terminal to the point that all of this Unixy goodness is available.
Yeah. And you are on the Mac Roundtable. We just did a Mac Roundtable together. So
that's true. Yeah.
MacRoundtable.com. Check that out also. And go visit the site. Check out the action. And again, don't be afraid of Automator. It's actually pretty powerful. And once you start, you know, once you get hooked, once you do one little thing, you'll find that you're more comfortable coming back to it and trying different stuff. You really can't break too much in here. I mean, be careful if you're manipulating your live documents. You probably want to make some test ones, but play around with
actually,
it and see what you can do.
A nice thing is when you drag in a dangerous action, it'll usually tell you, would you like to add a duplicate action before this action? Right. So if you try to drag in an action to delete a file, it will actually ask you, do you want me to duplicate it before you go ahead and do this delete action? So it's kind of hard to shoot yourself in the foot. If you try hard enough, I'm sure you'll succeed. But,
you know. Yeah, what's nice is, I mean, you could probably do it from the command line, but I don't think out of the box, because I remember writing an action one time and I couldn't find, there was no way to trash something or empty the trash natively. Like I had to go out and find an actual, somebody had written an Automator action for that. I could have done it from a terminal command, but I think out of the box, they try and protect you from doing really nasty stuff.
Which is good. I mean, even stuff like resizing an image, it will ask you, do you want to stick in a duplicate before the resize?
Yeah, which you probably do, especially if you're just experimenting.
Definitely, if you're just experimenting.
Get it around, get it right. Well, cool. Thank you, Bart. I appreciate you taking some time and also for just doing that whole post in action. That's really cool.
Yeah, I like to nerd out sometimes.
Take care.
Cheers, Adam. Bye-bye.
See, so Automator... Terminal, not so scary stuff, right? It's kind of cool the amount of powerful things that you can do with what's just built into your Mac. And it's easy to forget. It's easy to get lost with, oh, I got really simple, easy third-party tools. But sometimes it's really good to be able to get in and tinker a little bit yourself and actually see what's going on under the hood, peel back some of those nice gooey layers and get down there and dirty in the guts of the thing and build something yourself. So I hope that encourages you to maybe explore, check it out a little bit more if you haven't taken that opportunity. And I want to thank Bart for coming on and chatting with us about that and making that happen. When iOS 7 is released here in just a couple months, what would you think about having to repurchase all of your favorite applications? Again, pay the full price, whatever you paid for them originally, pay that again to help support the developers who are making this great software. And I'm asking that because the unofficial Apple weblog pointed to a post by Icon Factory's Gideon Mayhew where he was postulating exactly that thing. Like, would it be a good time now for developers to come out with new updated versions of their apps and charge for those new versions? So not updates, app updates, but whole new versions of the same applications that they could actually charge for. Now, he wasn't exactly arguing that this is something that they should do. He was just noting that this would be a good time and it could be an appropriate timing for that sort of thing to happen. Developers and designers could implement some of the new iOS 7 technologies along with new designs for their application that are more in line with the redesign for iOS 7 that Apple has put together. And so I'm posing the question to you as consumers, because that's really what it comes down to, right? You and I, how are we going to react if a developer asks us to pony up and pay for their application all over again? And those of you who are regular listeners might already know my thoughts on the subject, my answer. But basically, I think that in order for developers to be able to continue to make the great applications that they do, they need to have some kind of ongoing sustainable income for their apps. This is how software has worked for years, right? We purchase an application, we support the developer, and then there's this back and forth. They do minor releases and updates, usually for free, but then every once in a while there is a major new release, a major update, and that is a paid upgrade, usually at a discounted price. And that was how this worked for years, and it was a really good model. It worked for a lot of developers, but the App Store has thrown that all out of whack. It's completely changed how things are sold, and I don't know that it's necessarily for the better. As a matter of fact, the App Store has already forced pricing down to the extremes, especially on mobile platforms. Quality software is now at rock bottom levels, or just all software in general. There was a study, 90% of the apps on the App Store are now free, 6% are 99 cents. That means the remaining 4% of apps are the ones that cost more than 99%. That's only 4% of apps cost more than 99 cents. And this is according to the most recent Flurry Analytics numbers. And that's why I think we've seen this huge rise in developers flocking to the freemium model. And unfortunately, that also means that we're seeing a lot of crippleware. So you get something for free, but it's really limited in terms of its functionality. And then the app just annoys you with constantly needing to nickel and dime, 99 cents for this, 99 cents for that, just to get the functionality that you really want in the application. And I don't blame the developers for going down this model. I blame Apple mostly. And I blame us, and I blame Apple mostly because this freemium model solves two problems for developers. It solves the trial problem, so they can put out a free application with limited functionality, and that ends up serving as a free trial. So you can't do a 30-day free trial or something like that with an iOS app, so this gets around that problem. And then the freemium model, the in-app purchase model, gives them that ongoing revenue stream that they normally would get from just selling you the application up front for a fixed price and then being able to sell you updates later. I like that model. I miss that model. So I would love to see developers really create and charge for new versions of applications, maybe every 18 months or so, on that normal cycle that they used to put out normal updates for. I'd be happy to pay another full price for that app, be it 99 cents to 10 bucks to 15 bucks, whatever the app is, and do that every year to 18 months to be able to sustain that developer so that they keep wanting to create those quality apps for us, the applications that I love. That said, do I think that's ever going to happen? Do I think that consumers are going to be willing to do that now? No, I think the cat's out of the bag. I think Pandora's opened the box. Whatever metaphor you want to use, consumers are showing more and more that they're not willing to pay developers up front for that software for the sustained long term. We want free. We want 99 cents. And I'm using the proverbial we because I know a lot of us don't feel that way. But that's what you're going to have now. You're going to have what we have, apps that are cheap or free with limited functionality, and then you're going to pay through an app purchase to get the quote-unquote real version of the application. The one model that I do really like is developers who offer the sort of in-app purchase that is equivalent of just buying the full application, where you get all the bells and whistles for one fixed price, whatever that fixed price may be. That's my new favorite thing that kind of fits into this new model. But I really kind of hate it that the world is coming to this, I guess. And maybe I'm just old. I'm just lamenting the old days when we would pay for software and developers could make a living making this stuff. I just keep hearing from more and more developers that this new model is becoming infinitely more difficult for them to actually survive at. And, you know, I'm totally willing to accept we've got to rethink things and rethink the models and make changes for a new time, because I talk about wanting say, music publishers and book publishers and the movie and TV industry to change their thinking. So, you know, I gotta eat my own. What do they say? How do they say that? You gotta eat your own dog food. Yeah, I gotta eat my own dog food on this one. But what do you think? I mean, are you willing to go back to actually paying for quality software if the options were even made available and doing it on a regular basis? Or do you really like the new model? You like this the new way this is working, assuming it can sustain developers? And I think that's where the big question is can these new models really work for developers, or are we going to lose our quality software developers and just end up with the guys who constantly crank out one thing after the other and nickel and dime us? And you know, is this the new paradigm? I don't really know, but Gideon's piece just got me thinking about that. And of course, I'll have a link to that in the show notes at mattcast.com so you can read the full thing. And then finally for this week, I want to finish up with some quick calendar tips and tricks, some things that I realize I do on a daily basis. I've kind of adapted these over the years and they've really helped me out when I'm working with calendars in Mac OS X. So the first one actually just came up this week because I was scheduling this thing with Bart Bashatz, and he is in Ireland, and we had the whole time zone thing going on, and I started years ago using time zone support in Calendar. And if you go into Calendar and you go into the preferences and then click on the advanced tab, you can turn on time zone support. And if you're going to use this feature, you want to make sure that you also have your time zone set properly in the date and time system preferences. So go into system preferences, just make sure your time zone is set. But what happens is once you've turned this feature on is you can now create a meeting or an event with someone in a different time zone. And when you enter the time, you enter their time. So it makes it more convenient for the person you're scheduling with. You just say, what time are you available? And they can tell you their local time. And then you just set their time zone in the little time zone option that's now there. And once you've done that, what happens is in your calendar, you'll see it at the correct adjusted local time. And any alerts or reminders are going to happen at the correct local time, meaning you're not going to have to do any more math. You're not going to miss any more meetings because you put the entry in at their time zone. You see it in your time zone. The only caveat to this is in the info panel that pops up when you double click on an event, you're still going to see it in their time zone. And you'll note the time zone. It'll show what time zone the event is. But in the regular views, in your calendar views, when you're just looking at it in your calendar, you're going to see it at the correct local time for you. And that is really handy. Another thing that is handy is you will see it at the correct local time in the day and week views, but unfortunately the downside is it will not show up in by default, I don't think, in the month view, or at least it didn't do it for me. So in the month view, you just have the entry, and like I said, when you tap on it and get the info panel, it's going to show it at the time and time zone that you entered it in at. So you can actually change that as well. If you go into calendar preferences and then look at the general section down there at the bottom, there's a checkbox that says show event times in month view, or I think it just says show event times. If you check that on, now in the month view, it will actually show the time zone adjusted local time if you've enabled the time zone support right next to your entry in the month view. So that is particularly helpful if you're using the time zone support. But even if you just want to see the times of your events in your month view, check that option on. Another handy trick that I use all the time is setting up multiple alerts. So you probably know that when you enter a calendar event, you can set an alert. Maybe you want to have a message and a sound go off, or you want to get an email. You can turn that on, but did you know that you can set up multiples? So once you've set one, the same options become available again right underneath the reminder, the alert that you just set. So this, a lot of people I think use to set up maybe a message and sound and then also have an email sent. So that would be two different alerts. I personally, though, the thing I like to do is set up two message with sound reminders. So I usually set up one for the day before whatever meeting I have, and then another one 30 minutes to an hour or 2 hours before my scheduled meeting, depending upon whether I have to drive or if it's just going to be a phone meeting or something like that. So I might set that up, and that way I get reminded the day before, oh yeah, I got this thing coming up tomorrow. And then on the day, I also get a reminder. Can you tell I'm a little bit forgetful about things? This has been a lifesaver for me. Another really handy tip is attaching documents to your items in your calendar. So you can drag in a document associated with a meeting or event. Say you have a supporting PDF file or something, and you don't want to have to go hunting for it. You can just drag it right into the notes section of your calendar item, and it will attach it, and it'll even sync that across. If you're using iCloud syncing, it'll sync it across to your iOS devices. So you just have it there ready and handy when you need it, right when you're looking up your meeting information. So that's a really handy little trick. And then the last one is using data detectors, specifically in mail. In mail.app, if you have received an email from someone and they're like, hey, how about we have a meeting tomorrow at 8 a.m. or on Thursday the 29th at 8 a.m., whatever it might be. It can even be something like, hey, let's have lunch on Tuesday. If you hover over that thing with a date reference or a day reference or a time, it will outline it with a little dashed outline, and you'll see a little drop-down arrow. If you click on that, it'll pop out a calendar item info box to allow you to create an event for that in your calendar. And if you need to adjust or edit the details, you'll notice a little details button. If you click on that, it'll actually expand that window open. If you already have it expanded open, I think it says summary. So you click that to actually collapse it. But you can expand it open with the details button, and you can add additional information like reminders and different details about your event. And then when you click the add to calendar item, it will automatically, from mail, add that event to your calendar, and you never have to open mail. You never have to open calendar, and you never have to leave mail. So that's really handy for getting stuff into your calendar very quickly, directly from the mail app. And it has the added benefit that when you go back to your calendar and you're looking at the info panel for that item in calendar, there'll be a little show in mail link, and you can click that, and it'll take you right back to the original mail item that you created the event from. So that's really handy for finding your way back to the original email, because I often, you know, lose track of those emails, and that's a quick way for getting back. So some cool little tips that you can use in calendar. I'm sure you might have some of your own. If you do, send those along to maccast@gmail.com, and we'll try and bundle them up and maybe share some more cool calendar tips on future episodes of the Maccast. But that is going to do it for this week. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank all of my show sponsors. Smile, you can check out all of their software: Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disk Label, also Text Expander Touch for your iOS devices, as well as PDF Pen for iPhone and iPad. You can get all of the details over at smilesoftware.com. Transporter by Connected Data, you can get all the benefits of cloud storage with the control and security and privacy of a physical hard drive or NAS by checking out Transporter. It's personal, private cloud storage, and you can get 10% off your own personal cloud by using the offer code MACCAST and by going to filetransporter.com/MACCAST. So go there, use your code, you'll get 10% off your transporter. And Gazelle, the fast, simple way to sell your used gadgets. Find out what your used iPhone, iPad, and other Mac products are worth over at gazelle.com. And Squarespace, if you need to build a website, check out Squarespace. It is a beautiful, intuitive website publishing platform. It lets anyone easily create a professional web page, blog, online store, or gallery all on a single platform. You can try it completely free, no credit card required. Just go to squarespace.com to sign up. And when you purchase your new account, you can get 10% off when you use the offer code MACCAST7. Squarespace, everything you need to create an exceptional website. And a big thank you to all of my sponsors for their support of the MACCAST. A big thank you to you for your support. If you have a comment, a question, anything you'd like to let me know about, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MACCAST, you can send your email to maccast@gmail.com. You can also leave a voicemail on the MacCast hotline. That's at 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IM-9, or leave voicemail on Skype. My Skype address is the MacCast. And if you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you can find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And while you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. And if you'd like to follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/maccast, or check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/themaccast. And I'm also on app.net at MacCast. You can find the MacCast Google community on Google Plus by using MacCast. So pretty much MacCast on any social media site, and you're gonna find me there. So I look forward to seeing you online. But until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.